I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. They talked in secret for 2 years before announcing what's now called the Geneva Accord. This plan for Mideast peace, though drafted by outsiders, actually goes straight to the most controversial inside issues. A proposal for shared jurisdiction over Jerusalem, a shifting back to the boundaries of 1967, setting aside most of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip for a Palestinian state, along with a right of return for refugees to that land. The Geneva Accord has been widely circulated in Israel and the occupied territories, but it's recently been gathering more attention for the leaders who are talking about it. Last Friday, the authors met with U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell over the weekend. There were heated debates in Israel's cabinet. So, what is the role of outsiders in the peace process? Does this hinder the work of the people who are elected to do the job? Or is it the duty of citizens to act when they think they can make progress where their leaders have not? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We start today's program with the two men who are principal architects of this Geneva Accord. Yossi Beilon is a former justice minister from Israel. Yasser Abed-Rabo is a former Palestinian minister of information and still on the PLO executive committee. We arranged a bit earlier to get them together when they were both still in Washington, and I began by asking Yossi Beilon if he believed all the recent talk of ceasefires and different approaches to peace were triggered by the proposals in the Geneva Accord.
I think that we revived the substantial debate of the permanent solution rather than the debate about what are we going to do with Yasser Arafat, whether to kill him or expel him and all these stupidities. Now we are back to substance, and I think that it is a very, very important contribution.
Mr. Rabo, from you on that.
Well, we believe that we had started a process which had encouraged so many parties to present their ideas. And we believe that some political parties, for example, in Israel, had declared that they intend to make political initiatives exactly after the declaration of the Geneva Accord. And on the Palestinian side, of course, there is opposition, but I can assure you that the Palestinian mainstream is taking a very positive position towards the Geneva Accord. The opposition maybe is trying to express its position in many ways, including demonstrations, but we welcome that, and we are encouraging the dialogue and the debate, and we are part of a continuous process of debate among the Palestinians because we believe this is much better than the atmosphere that had prevailed for the past 3 years among the Palestinians, and this might lead into creating a better hope for the future.
All right, but Mr. Beilon, you two are both very seasoned politicians. You know this has tremendous political echoes within Israel itself. You seem to have put Prime Minister Ariel Sharon very much on the defensive by pushing the Geneva Accord. He, in turn, has called you a traitor. So at the same time as you're saying you're speaking in broad general terms to the people and world leaders, this has real political power at home as well.
Undoubtedly, that is exactly what I want. That is what we need. Speaking about the whole group of signatories on the Israeli side, people like the former chief of staff, people like the deputy head of the Mossad, the head of the security service, all of us would like to have influence on the public opinion and through it on the government in order to change the policy of the Sharon government and to get back to the negotiating table on the permanent solution through the roadmap. This is our aim. We succeeded doing it with the decision of a unilateral withdrawal from Lebanon in the past when I led the public movement towards such a withdrawal. And I believe that the public opinion in such a democracy like in Israel is the most important asset that we have. And it is true. By talking to people in the world, it has an impact on the public opinion in a positive way, and it increases the prospects for more people to support our view.
Okay, but you've got the Prime Minister calling you publicly a traitor, and just what you have said in terms of your hopes to try and move his position, gives fuel to what those critics are saying. They're saying you're not elected. You have no right to be talking about the detail of these issues as an outsider.
I must say that as a teacher of political science, I taught my students that democracy is much closer to the Tocqueville view about civil society than elections every 5 or 4 years. The civil society is vibrant in such democracies, and it has the right to lobby, to express views, and to try to change the view of the government. We believe that we are very close to an abyss. God forbid that it is a very, very dangerous situation now on the ground, both because of violence and because of the demographic situation, whereby Israel might be a state with a Jewish minority dominating an Arab majority. This is intolerable, and we want to save ourselves before it is too late. And I believe, as patriots, this is our duty.
But you're also very close to a line here, aren't you? Because there comes a point when you really are, in fact, dealing in matters which should be handled only by the elected politicians. You must admit you're close to the line on this.
Not at all. In my view, we are very, very far from this line, because we don't pretend ourselves to be the negotiators or the decision makers. It is up to the government of Israel. It also was in the past when we were in power and people from the right, from the opposition, tried to change the view of the government, to talk to the American Congress and to others in order to convince them. I think that maybe it is not convenient that for any government, including our government in the past, but it is very legitimate and democratic.
Mr. Abed Rabo, I'd like to speak briefly, if I could, about the U.S.-sponsored roadmap, which has gone virtually nowhere in the past few months. It deals in very, very small steps with confidence building, and it stays away from the hot-button final status issues, like the right of return, like who gets to control Jerusalem. I wonder if the reason your Geneva Accord is so controversial and attracting so much attention is that you've gone straight to those issues.
Exactly. In the past, there were so many initiatives, and the roadmap tried, in fact, to pave the way towards the final status solutions. It's not in itself a final status solution. The roadmap dealt with the security issues, with the confidence building, with the question of settlements, and the different issues related to elections and others. But the roadmap considered that this should be an introduction to the final status solutions. We wanted to complement the roadmap. We wanted to give it more strength by introducing this detailed, comprehensive solution we have. And this is the major, maybe, achievement we made through the Geneva Accord.
But what's the risk, though, Mr. Abed Rabo, that you just put too much on the table, that there are these options in the Geneva Accord, and there are these ideas in Sari Nusseibeh's peace accord, and there are these things on the roadmap, and nobody ends up knowing what's really at stake here?
No. So the main thing that both sides, the Israeli public and the Palestinian public, had needed after all the attempts in Camp David and after Camp David, is a very comprehensive plan that does not leave any vague issues unresolved, because this will prove to both sides first and to the world after that there is a possible solution and there is a possible partnership. There are so many extremist forces in Israel and Palestine who took advantage of our failures in the past, in the previous negotiations, to claim that no possible solution. So the only thing which will be possible is the continuation of this cycle of violence. We wanted to prove here is a solution. This solution, if it is accepted by the two governments, it will be implemented tomorrow, and all the pains and agonies of both nations will be put to an end.
Yossi Beilin, you had a meeting with Secretary of State Colin Powell. Tell me, as someone who's been through this cycle before, what do you really expect Washington to do or to be able to do with this now?
Well, of course, Washington is very, very important for any deal in the future. I think that the roadmap, which has been proposed by the quartet led by the United States, is now being revived through our Geneva Accord, because the Geneva Accord is suggesting the content for the third stage of the roadmap, which is the permanent solution, and this might help us in order to implement the two other stages, which is the confidence building measures and the Palestinian state in provisional borders. I think that if Washington understands, and I think that this is the case, that we can help implementing the roadmap, then it might refer to it as a very serious attempt to change the situation for the better, which might have impact not only on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but on the Middle East, generally speaking.
And you both know that a principal criticism of this deal has been that it stands, or can be seen to stand, as a reward for 3 years of violence, 3 years of suicide bombings, 3 years of targeted assassinations. How do you argue against that?
We are not in the kindergarten, with all due respect. And the question of rewarding bad pupils is something which is not important for us. We want to save ourselves. We want to save our children. If this is a solution which can save us, so I don't believe that anybody will take seriously the question of whether we are rewarding somebody or not. I'll tell you something. We are rewarding the pragmatic forces, and we are punishing the extremists in this region if we find a solution. This is what we are doing. I think that this is vital for both suffering peoples to save themselves, and this is an option to do that.
I believe that those who adopt that theory about rewarding violence believe that in order to stop violence, you need more violence, and this cycle will continue forever. We are not rewarding anybody. We are trying to reward our both nations with peace. Peace which is built on equality, peace which is built on having two states with good neighbor relations between each other, peace which is built on ending all forms of claims between the two sides, and peace where the two sides will coexist and live with each other. This is the real reward that we want to give to both nations, and this we will achieve with the help and support of the two public opinions and with the international public opinion as well.
Yasser Abed-Rabo, thanks for being with us on the program today.
Thank you, sir.
Yossi Beilin, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
When we come back, a chance to ask some more questions about this and hear questions from you as well. What's the role of outsiders in the peace process? Do they hinder the work of the people who are elected to do the job, or is it the duty of citizens to act when they think they can make progress where their leaders have not? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And when we do come back, we'll be talking with Robert Malley, Middle East Program Director at the International Crisis Group, and one of those who helped advise the Geneva Accord teams. We'll also be talking with Ari Shavit, senior columnist with the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. He has written about the inherent dangers of this seemingly innocent document. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Does the Geneva Accord matter? Is it interference in Middle East peace, or are these sorts of alternate peace plans in fact helpful? To continue the program with us on this subject, Ari Shavit, senior columnist with the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. He's joining us from a studio near Tel Aviv. Ari, nice to have you back on the program.
Good morning.
And Robert Malley, Middle East Program Director at the International Crisis Group, joining us from Washington. Robert, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Robert, you had a role. What exactly was your role in the Geneva Accord in terms of advising the two sides?
Well, just at the outset, now it goes back at least a year and a half ago, I think they just wanted to have some sense of what had been done in the past, whether it was at Camp David or in the proposals that President Clinton, who I worked for, had presented in December 2000. So they wanted to sort of use my memory and get some reactions to what they were doing. But that was early on, and after that, it really was they were on their own.
And you obviously had some reason for wanting to be involved. The fact that it is getting the attention that it's getting right now, is that what you had in mind a year and a half ago?
Well, who knows what we had in mind a year and a half ago, but I do think a key idea that at least I had, and I suspect they had as well, was to break some of the myths that had evolved since the collapse of the peace talks in the year 2000-2001, myths on the Palestinian side that the only way to achieve their aspirations was through violence, and the myth on the Israeli side that there was nobody on the other side, or at least not serious Palestinians who were prepared to accept Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state. And I think it was important to try to debunk those two myths and to show that a solution was possible, and to work it out and to present it to the Israeli and Palestinian publics and to the international community.
Ari Shavit, help me with your perspective on this, because the Geneva Accord, the substance of it, has been out there in the public eye for almost a month now, despite the fact that it got a lot of its media attention just over the past week. You said that when it first came out, you regarded it with some sympathy, but your point of view has changed. Can you explain that?
Yes, I think the Geneva initiative had some positive element in steering things up and really suggesting some sort of alternative. But I think the importance of it, the positive importance, was in suggesting something to both peoples. As long as the Geneva Accord was put on the table, both of Palestinians and Israelis, for internal debates, I think it was legitimate, and I think it also had a positive, constructive role. The moment the leaders of this initiative went abroad, went to the international community, went to Geneva, and went to Washington, that moment I think the initiative became not legitimate and deeply disturbing from a democratic point of view. Because as I see, this is an attempt of basically a group of Israelis working along with the Palestinian Authority to seduce public opinion, international public opinion, into enforcing a settlement, a vision of their own on the Israeli public and the Palestinian public. That is wrong, I think, morally. I think also as far as substance, this is wrong, and politically it's counterproductive.
I don't quite see the distinction that you're drawing. I mean, the Europeans and the Americans have been intimately involved with just about every peace effort that I can recall in the Middle East. So what difference does it make if these two, Abid Rabo and Balin, take their document and go abroad with it?
Because say the debate about the war in the United States, that was definitely a very legitimate debate. But say the opposition, the anti-war movement, would have gone and started negotiating and drafting a contract and some sort of solution with Mr. Hussein before the war and taking it to the UN immediately afterwards, I think that it would have been perceived in America as something that is undermining the American democratic process. This is exactly what happened here.
Robert Malley, do you see that parallel?
I don't. But in any event, I think it's good to come back to this situation. I understand there are many Israelis and many Palestinians who are not particularly happy with the Geneva Initiative. From my point of view, I don't think either of the proponents of the Geneva Initiative are asking anyone to impose this. Certainly that would not be my view, and I think it would be an unrealistic way of looking at politics and not the right way of looking at it. I do think, as you said, that the international community has been intimately involved, and the United States more than anyone else, in trying to broker agreements between Israelis and Palestinians. As you said, and over the last 2 years, one could mention at least three or four initiatives that the U.S. has put on the table, none of which have worked, by the way. And the cost of the conflict is obviously felt mainly by the Israeli and Palestinian people. It's also felt by the rest of the international community in countless different ways. So to have Israelis and Palestinians try to come and present their point of view to the U.S. administration, which is not about to be simply convinced and persuaded because a group of Israelis and Palestinians come to talk to them, and not about to change its policy because of that, But if its policy could be informed by it, if public opinion here in the United States could start manifesting itself in ways to try to change the views of the administration, again, I don't see anything illegitimate in that. It's perfectly within, it's consistent with what's been happening over the last decade of the U.S. trying to come up with a policy that could help Israelis and Palestinians get out of their conflict. So the parallels with the Iraq situation, I think, are just, you know, there's a superficial parallelism, but the conflict is very different. The role of the international community has been very different. And the solutions, frankly, the solutions that Israelis and Palestinians who came together in Geneva to try to come up with something are not very far from the outcomes that President Clinton, that Prime Minister Barak, and that others had been working on over the years. So I don't see this as a betrayal of what had been in mind. It's just a completion and an attempt to show that these could be brought to conclusion.
All right, let's hear from some of our listeners on this. Our number one is 1-800-423-8255 to Madison, Tennessee, and Adele's joining us. Hi, Adele, what do you think?
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, my problem is every time some group of people try to help solve a problem or help the government, if we don't like those people, then we start saying the message is wrong or the way they deliver the message is wrong. We need peace. We live in a society, in a world today that everybody's talking about who are we going to kill today, who are we going to kill tomorrow, who are we going to let live. What is wrong in two group of people going to Geneva to make some progress about peace? I just want to know that.
Harry.
Yes, I think that the tragedy of this conflict is that experience tells us that when you aim too high, and you're too ambitious, and you do not prepare the grounds well, the attempt for achieving perfect or overall peace, the result of that is terrible bloodshed. We've experienced the worst sort of bloodshed, terror and occupation related, over the last 3 years, that erupted immediately after a very bold attempt to reach this perfect peace. So I think that if we want to learn from that lesson, we have to know that when we approach this problem, this very delicate and very complex problem, and when we try to move forward, we have to be very cautious.
Are you saying
in
to
my mind the problem moving beyond the procedure and the democratic issue? I think that this document is deeply flawed and deeply dangerous. Not because I want Israeli occupation to go on. On the contrary, I want Israeli occupation to end. I want to see a Palestinian state. I have believed for 20 years in the two-state solution. But the two-state solution is a very delicate and very dangerous. It must be handled right. In my mind, this document is immature and very, very dangerous. And I suggest to the listeners not to take anyone speaking for peace as someone who will deliver peace. It's not automatic. You have to look at the details. They are complex. They are difficult. But I believe that these people who really meant the best, they have the best intentions, brought about a very dangerous document with a very dangerous suggestion that if it would be accepted, I see much more bloodshed as a result of it than before.
Adele, what do you think?
Well, I don't think those people are asking for perfect peace. They never asked for that. All they say, give us a chance, give the world a chance. I mean, what alternative do we have? We have people killing each other every day. What more bloodshed do we need to think that somehow people who are elected, they have perfect solutions? And we know from history, too, that those people generally don't have perfect solutions.
But Adele, just because the people who are pushing the accord say it's a good idea and this will lead to peace doesn't necessarily mean that that's the case.
It doesn't. But it doesn't mean it won't. If you don't try, how will you know? And I'm so tired of hearing every time we try to do something, then some people who are against that, they'll come out and say, well, in America you did this. I mean, leave America. Don't be telling people we know what we've done. Oh, America, how would you like somebody go to United Nations and say we have a peace for Iraq? Why do they have to bring America to it every time to slap something back on our face? Everybody in the world wants peace. Everybody wants peace. And there's no need for people to be trying to put it to try to get America and say, America should have done this. America, how would you lie if we did this to you?
Adele, let's get Robert Malley in here. Because, Robert, when we look at what's in the Geneva Accord, Ari's pointing us very specifically to the fact that, unlike the U.S. roadmap, unlike the Oslo Accord, this is a piece of paper or a 50-page document which goes to the final status issues, as they're called, but the sort of hot-button topics like the right of return for refugees, control over Jerusalem, who gets which land. And Ari says that's in many ways why it's so dangerous. What do you think?
Well, I think that's the debate one should have, as opposed to the procedural debate about whether what they did was legitimate or illegitimate, whether they were coming to the U.S. The real debate is, have the way in which people have tried to approach the peace process since Oslo, over the last 10 years, been successful? I think the answer is pretty clear. One just needs to look at what's happening in Israel and on the Palestinian side. And is there an alternative approach that could work? And what the Geneva people and what others have been working on over the past few years is to try to come up with an approach that would not defer the final status issues, but look at them up front, because the other way, the incremental approach, the step-by-step approach, which defers the difficult issues, leads both sides to hold back on their negotiating positions because they're waiting for that day when the final issues will be put on the table, which polarizes the situation. That has not worked. It's led to the collapse of the Oslo Agreement. It's led to the collapse of Camp David. It's led to the collapse of everything we've seen tried over the last decade. This is a different approach. I'm convinced that it has a much greater chance of success. It hasn't been tried yet. So people say it's dangerous, but what could be more dangerous than the situation we're in today, where Israelis and Palestinians are being killed for the sake of a process that doesn't even have a destination? I believe that if you put those issues on the table, if the two sides could agree on what the final destination would be, I think it would be much easier for them to take the kind of steps that all recognize have to be taken, the kind of steps that are described in the roadmap.
Okay.
But if you don't put that on the table, they have no incentive to do it. They have every incentive to hold back.
Adele, thanks very much for your call. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Ari, I want to come back to you on this, because I hear the point that Robert is making, that nothing else has worked, and that, so to say that this is worse or no better or not worth looking at. I know there are people listening to us now scratching their heads going, well, so what is the solution?
First, I tell you what was not right. Because of this constant debate over the final status between, basically in Israel, between right-wing paralysis and these offers of very radical offers of the rather far left, actually nothing happened. Nothing was done. We didn't try getting out of the Gaza Strip and see what happened. We didn't try establishing a Palestinian state on, say, 70, 80, 90% of the territories. We didn't try, uprooting dozens of settlements, things that can be done and were not tried. But I want to refer to Mr. Mali's point. He thinks nothing can be worse than the present situation. I think that having Yasser Arafat in control of the Temple Mount is probably the most dangerous thing you can have. I want to remind your listeners, Yasser Arafat is a Palestinian dictator. He was talking of a million martyrs walking to Jerusalem. He's deeply corrupt. He's not a democratic leader. He has a very destructive ethos that he's running his society on. And giving this man control of probably the most sensitive point in the world, with the possibility of endangering the entire Middle East, because the sensitivities concerning the Temple Mount are amazing throughout the Islamic world and the Christian world. I think that vision is as dangerous and probably more dangerous than the present situation.
All right, let's get back.
And this is why, if just say one more sentence, I think there was a lot of wisdom in the Bush vision of having a democratic Palestine, of having Palestinian reform as part of the process of establishing a Palestinian state. The Geneva Accord abandons that target, and I think this is its main fallacy. I think this is wrong. I think we must work for a democratic Palestine. Geneva Accord doesn't offer that.
Robert Malley.
Well, we could get into a debate about, obviously, the merits of the Bush administration's approach. I believe, again, the notion that you're going to get the Palestinians to accept a reform process under conditions of occupation without knowing whether at the end of the day their aspirations are going to be fulfilled is a fallacy. Now, we could talk about Geneva, about a final status solution. There's no requirement that once you put that solution on the table, you don't work backwards then to say, here are certain things that both sides have to do. And one of them could be and should be reform of Palestinian institutions. But the question is, can you get there if you don't say ahead of time what both sides are going to get? I would add this. I mean, the number one, the Geneva Court is not necessarily what the end game will be. I think the kind of debate about what can work in it, what won't work in it, has to be launched. I think that it would be very hard for any Israeli or any Palestinian to come up with an agreement that is fundamentally different from the one that was drawn up in Geneva that you'd find majorities on both sides prepared to accept. I think Geneva has that potential. There may have to be some changes to it. I'd add that on the issue of the Temple Mount, the agreement has an international supervision, oversight, governance of the holy site so that neither side can do things unilaterally. I think that's an important piece. It may not be enough, but then that's what needs to be discussed. But to think that you could come up with an agreement that will satisfy all of the Palestinian needs or all of the Israeli needs and have the other side accept it is another fantasy. You're going to have compromise, and you're going to have it in a way that has enough guarantees so that neither side will fear the worst from its partner.
All right, Connection listeners, what is the role of outsiders when they try to pull together the sort of peace accord that the Geneva Accord represents? Is it a dangerous document? Does it give too many people too many options? Does it complicate what is already one of the most complicated peace conversations going on anywhere in the world? Or is it a useful contribution by citizens who are trying to get their leaders more actively engaged in peace? And I'm talking about here in the United States, too, whether or not the Geneva Accord appears to have had anything to do in getting both Colin Powell or President Bush more engaged in Middle East peace. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Assessing the Geneva Accord and its impact on Middle East peace this hour. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Ari Shavit is with us. He's a senior columnist with the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. And Robert Malley is also on the program. He's Middle East Program Director at the International Crisis Group. We're going to go to Newton, Massachusetts now. Samuel is with us. Hi, Samuel. What do you think?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I would like to take 2 points with Robert Malley and summarize what he said. There are 2 issues. The first one is wishful thinking, which says, you know, the situation is terrible and therefore we need to move. The second one is putting parallelism between previous involvement of the United States and European government in the peace process and the one which is done in Geneva. It's not so. There was never involvement of the United States government in negotiations which were not represented by the Israeli government. Either it was Rabin, Barak, or Sharon. In all cases, the United States government tried to assist a legitimate Israeli government in negotiating a peace process. One has to see, what do the Israelis think?
Samuel, can I just be clear on that?
Sure.
My understanding is that the United States government didn't have anything to do with the negotiation of the Geneva Accord, and they have been, so far, very, very careful not to embrace its recommendations, but simply to say, oh, it looks helpful, we'll keep it in mind, right?
Well, but the point is that in many processes, like the Powell meeting with the Geneva people, there is an underlying process in which the United States government, or more bluntly, the European government, undermining the democratic process in Israel. If one looks at the results of the Israeli elections, where people that now negotiate in Geneva were essentially kicked out of the Israeli parliament, and completely lost any support of the Israeli public, one has to ask itself or himself, what is the legitimation of that group negotiating in Geneva? Does it help us at the end of the day, or it doesn't?
Okay, Robert.
Forward or backwards?
Samuel, just take a breath here. I want to hear Robert on this, on your suggestion that this is, in fact, undermining the democratic representatives in Israel when it goes as broad as it has.
Again, I just think one has to calm down a little bit. As you said, all the administration has done is had a few meetings, and every time made perfectly clear they weren't endorsing the substance of what was being discussed. They wanted to meet with these people, which they do, by the way, all the time with non-officials from countries around the globe, listening to their ideas. Sometimes these people come together with somebody from another side trying to advocate a particular solution. Doesn't have any. The only reason this time it's had such a huge impact is because people see the paralysis of the situation on the ground, and so this particular initiative has more resonance. At the end of the day, nobody is talking about the United States endorsing Geneva and imposing it on anyone, but we do know that the United States has a huge impact in suggesting solutions to the Israelis and Palestinians, and the administration should be informed. And I myself would be perfectly happy if one day the United States told the Israeli and Palestinian authorities, we have a peace plan. We're not imposing it on you. We would like you to submit it to your own peoples in a referendum. It could be Geneva. It could be not Geneva. It could be something very different. But asking the peoples to decide, the United States shouldn't impose anything, but has a large military, diplomatic, political, and moral weight in the region, and it should exercise it, I think, in the wisest way possible, and that means it has to listen to all points of view. And I honestly do not see how this is undermined in any way Israel's democratic system or the Palestinian system, for that matter, because both authorities are free to say yes or no to any initiative. Israeli and Palestinian public are mature enough to judge these proposals on their merits.
Okay,
and I think the debate should be on the merits.
Ari, this is not the way you're seeing it.
No, I have no problem with Secretary Powell. I have no complaints there. I think he has the right to meet anyone he wishes. I have a serious problem with Mr. Bailyn's way of doing politics. This goes very deep. One of the reasons that all the previous peace process collapsed is because it was perceived, many Israelis perceived it as a process of Israeli WASPs, elitistic, rather arrogant in their approach to other Israelis.
These are the PC uppies that you write about?
Exactly. Ignoring the fears and concerns of the Israeli majority. And what Mr. Bailyn just did is to prove that he learned nothing from that failure the previous time. And I'm really worried. I must say I'm troubled by the American democratic partners of these Israeli gentlemen who are supposed to represent a democratic spirit. And somehow they fail to understand what it looks like from a democratic point of view to an ordinary Israeli. Mr. Mali must understand we are talking about a life and death question. We don't know what the truth is, but these suggestions might mean life or death for the state of Israel. So when we come to approach such a critical issue that no other nation on earth faces, the democratic procedure must be meticulous. It must be our own decision carried out in a very clear democratic way. By the way, I think this is a major democratic challenge for the world to watch. No other democracy is confronted with such issues. So when people who are supposed to represent a democratic spirit actually impose their will or go around the will of their own people, and rather than go to the town halls in Israel and talk to Israelis and convince them, they go to Washington, this is very, very disturbing.
Robert, you as an American what Ari is saying is that you as a student of American democracy ought to be concerned about it for that reason.
I think what most people should be concerned about is what's happening in the region, and anything. And this may not be the way that will resolve the crisis, but any idea to get it out should be considered, that's what should be considered meticulously and seriously. And I would add, as far as I know, neither Yossi Bailyn nor Yasser Ben Rabo has asked anyone to impose anything on anybody else. They, in fact, have emphasized, as I would, that at the end of the day, the Israeli and Palestinian people, through their own political processes, are going to have to agree to a solution or disagree on a solution. If at the end of the day, the Israeli and Palestinian public in a referendum were to vote up on it and to endorse something like Geneva, who could then quibble with the means through which that happened? Whether it was because Yossi Bell and Yasser Abdel-Rabo had a good meeting with Secretary Powell and that they then suggested it to Ariel Sharon and Yasser Arafat, who knows how it might happen. If at the end of the day the two peoples agreed to a solution, that's a democratic process, that's the right outcome for the two peoples. And all,
right,
all the rest is just talk.
Let's get back to our phones if we can. To Spokane, Washington, Abdullah's joining us. Hi, Abdullah.
Yeah, hi, good morning.
So what do you think?
I'm, as a Palestinian-American, I'm very much in support. I see there has been failure on both sides, on both political leaderships, to propose anything that has been, that came anywhere near working. The majority of the public on both sides, I think, I'm more familiar with the Palestinian side, firmly believe that the only solution is land for peace. All these formulas that have been proposed basically rotate around the concept of land for peace, which is what this one is. And I'm very hopeful that this one will lead to at least a little bit of dialogue and at least the fact that it's putting pressure on both governments to say, hey, listen, we need to make a change here. This is not working.
Ari is saying that it's not putting pressure on Yasser Arafat, that it is simply, you know, one more way of Yasser Arafat negotiating, you know, through two doors at the same particular time.
The Palestinians, in my opinion, are always going to leak. You know, both sides are keeping all their options open. I mean, both sides want to present to the other side, listen, we want peace, but on the other hand, if peace doesn't work out, we're going to do this. They're going to carry a stick. Both sides are carrying a stick. Different size sticks, but both sides will carry a stick. Another interesting phenomenon for me is who is opposing this proposal. Who's opposing is the militants on the Palestinian side, and interestingly, the government on the Israeli side, which kind of, in a way, crystallizes where radicalism lies on both sides of this equation.
Well, let's be fair to Ariel Sharon. He is trying to manage a coalition government, so it's hard to know when they're taking a position. Is it the entire government? Is he speaking for one particular faction? You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Ari Shavit, the idea of asymmetry that you've been writing about, is there a simple way of explaining why this is the asymmetrical nature of this type of negotiation is part of the problem?
Yes, I think that there is the problem here again of the fact that on the one side the negotiators, the Palestinian negotiators, were working under the instructions of Mr. Arafat, who has not committed himself to the document. And on the other side, there was a group of Israelis, you know, from the opposition who don't have any clear mandate. The problem, again, I want to remind the listeners something perhaps they don't know. We had previous documents before. Mr. Beilin himself with Mr. Abu Mazen have produced a paper in 1995 which seemed to be the formula for a final status peace agreement. Later, when this was presented to the Palestinians under Ehud Barak, at the time of Ehud Barak, they were not willing to accept it as a peace deal. So these documents actually serve to change public opinion and to erode the Israeli position. But at the end of the day, the Palestinians don't feel they are committed to them.
Abdallah,
a question?
He's actually not on the line anymore. So what I'd like to do, if I can, just taking a look at the time we have left on the program, is get a sense of how this is playing out today. Because we watched arguments in the Knesset over the weekend, saw quotes from Deputy Prime Minister Ehud Olmert saying that maybe it was time to do some sort of unilateral shift back to the borders of 1967. So how are we to understand the effect of the Geneva Accord on what's going on right now? I mean, in one sense, you can say, look, they're democratically elected people. They're going to take what they want from that and disregard what they don't want.
After saying many pessimistic things, I'd like to approach the end with a more positive, optimistic note. I think something very positive is happening definitely in Israel, hopefully on the Palestinian side as well. It's not a result of the initiative, but it has a certain role in it. I think we are witnessing the real, not only decline, but probably the real end of the Israeli right. I think after 3 years of violence and after more than 35 years of occupation, we're approaching really the last days of the greater Israel idea. And I think what happened with Mr. Olmert of the Israeli, the deputy prime minister, is only the first sign. I'm hopeful that we'll see more. I think that we will not see a final status agreement and a full overall peace, but there is a good chance we'll see dramatic, meaningful changes towards the end of occupation because the Israeli right realizes there is no hope in what it offered. And I think this is where real hope lies, not in utopian ideas.
And Robert Malley, if as Ari looks at the short-term future ahead, the way he has just described it, is this not then a moment or an opportunity for people in Washington to perhaps set aside their roadmap and say, all right, let's deal with exactly what's going on in Israel now and help the two sides move in that direction?
Well, I certainly think that one could at least complement the roadmap and accelerate it by adding to it a real discussion of the final status issues. I've been more optimistic. I want to add, not a pessimistic note, but at least say that I do think we may be closer today, as Mr. Shavit just said, to the end of Greater Israel. We may also be closer than ever before to the end of the two-state solution. Time is not on the side of those who believe in an equitable partition of the land. If time goes by at this rate, with hardening of positions, certainly on the Palestinian side, on the Palestinian public side, where because of what's happening in terms of settlements and the facts on the ground, but just ideological phenomena that are occurring on the Palestinian side, the demographics, one may be in a situation where 5 years from now, a few years from now, a two-state solution is no longer possible. And all this talk about unilateral separation and step-by-step approach and incremental approach will just be ancient history. One has to move relatively fast and relatively ambitiously if you want to save Israel and the Palestinians from a future that will be worse than the present they're currently living.
Robert Malley, thanks for being with us on the program today.
Thank you.
Robert Malley, Middle East Program Director at the International Crisis Group. Ari Shavit, as ever, good to have you on the program.
Thank you very much.
Ari is a columnist with the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. Earlier, I spoke with the two initiators of the Geneva Plan, Yasser Abed Rabo, former Palestinian Minister of Culture and Information, Yossi Veilen, former Israeli Justice Minister. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.